Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to CrimeWire Investigates, an elite team of veteran investigation experts along with noted crime consultants and attorneys often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The CrimeWire team, Vito Colucci Jr., private eye and author, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, and Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there on the top of the crime at the top of their game. CrimeWire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in anytime during the show. The number is 646-478-0982. You can also join our live chat going on now or email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. If you have a friend or family member and you'd like to send the CrimeWire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death, or if you'd like CrimeWire to consider a case for a future show, our email address is thecrimewire@gmail.com. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to CrimeWire.
Well, good evening, Susan and everybody.
We actually also have Peter Hyatt with us.
Hi, Peter.
Good evening. Hi, all.
Hi, Peter.
Well, what I'd like to do, first of all, I want to just throw out a little question to our listeners, and they can blog us either tonight or talk to us during the week. We want to know what you think of our new picture that we have up on our site. Delilah had done great work for us, and she posted this brand new picture of us for the CrimeWire team. So please let us know on the blogs or let us know through emails or whatever if you like her. I think she did a heck of a job there.
Or if you're a graphic artist and want to submit something, then we'll take that under consideration as well.
That's right. That's right. But very, very good job, ladies. That was excellent. Excellent. Well, what we're going to do is, each week, we're going to talk for a few minutes about a case. We're going to highlight a case. We are not going to discuss this case this evening. We're going to discuss this case 2 weeks from now on July the 13th. But I want to give you the background of this case because this case was featured quite a bit on TV. I talked about it on many different shows. Something to think about over the next couple weeks, okay? We'd like to highlight the unsolved murder case of Morgan Dana Harrington, who vanished while attending a Metallica concert on October 16, 2009, in Charlottesville, Virginia. Morgan Harrington's body was found in Elmer Leigh County on January 26, 2010. The person or persons responsible remain at large, presumably still in the Charlottesville area. The family is asking that any information that might help in the investigation of this case be directed to the Virginia State Police tip line, 434-352-3467. Please remember, all tips remain confidential. And also, at the end of the show, and when you have a chance, please take a moment to visit that website at www.findmorgan.com. The Harrington family is offering a $100,000 reward for the safe return of their daughter, Morgan Harrington, or any information leading to the arrest and conviction of the person or persons responsible for Morgan Harrington's disappearance. In addition, the band Metallica, and kudos out to them, that's for sure, is offering an additional $50,000 to bring the reward up to $150,000 for Morgan's safe return or information leading to the arrest and conviction of the person or persons responsible for Morgan's disappearance.
No, I'm sorry, Vito, it's her death. She was. It's her information to the killer.
Oh, okay. I didn't see that on there. Okay, no problem. But what we're going to do at CrimeWire, we were going to feature Morgan Harrington's case on July the 13th.
Evening, Denny Griffin, and welcome to the guests and the panelists and our listeners. And before I get into our first segment tonight, I'd like to also welcome Pat Caristo. She's one of our CrimeWire consultants. She's a professional investigator, licensed and director of NIA/NM, a nonprofit investigative agency in Albuquerque, New Mexico, offering pro bono service to victims or families of violent crimes and cases involving the elderly. Her website is www.nia-nm.com. Pat, welcome to CrimeWire.
Thank you. I'm honored to be asked.
Okay. In our first segment tonight, we're going to talk about the case of the murder of Debbie Whitlock. And we're going to be speaking tonight with Debbie's mother, Jackie McDonald. And in the way of background, Jackie's life was forever changed when she received a phone call in 1988 advising that her daughter had been murdered while her three-year-old daughter was sleeping nearby. And when the killer or suspect, there was no arrest made, Jackie took it upon herself to track down the killer. It was a nine-year effort, and it ended with success. Jackie McDonald, welcome to CrimeWire.
And thank you for having me on.
You're very welcome. Tell us a little bit, if you will, Jackie. Let's go back to that phone call in 1988 and tell us what happened that night.
Well, actually, I had received a phone call from my husband's work looking for him, and he was visiting his mother. But that night when they returned, his mother came back to Minnesota. She was visiting us for the first time. I told my husband, I said, you better phone your work, and then we can sit and have dinner. And I always remember he walked back into the family room, and he looked so strange. And I said, what was the phone call? And he said, Cliff called, and that was Karen, my youngest daughter's husband. And I said, oh, my God, Karen. And he said, no, Debbie. And my next question, well, what happened? And he swears he didn't say this, but this is what I heard. Somebody cut her throat. And I went into shock. He found me walking up and down the street. I have no recollection of how I got there. And then, of course, you know, I'll try and speed this up. Friends came over, the minister came over, and all I wanted to do was go in the bedroom, get in a fetal position behind the nightstand and block the world out so it hadn't happened. And that's how it all began. Shall I continue?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Please do.
Well, it's funny because my daughter was living in Modesto. She was murdered in Modesto, so we had to come. I called Merced home, which is near Modesto. We had to come home for the funeral, and I was fighting it because in my mind, if I wasn't in California, Debbie wasn't dead. Anyway, long story short, we came home, and I remember saying to Karen that I needed to buy a black dress, and she said, no, Mother, everyone's wearing blue, Debbie's favorite color. And, of course, there was a funeral, and then we went back to Minnesota where we were living. And the first thing my second husband, not Debbie's father, allowed me to do was put our new house on the market so he could bring me back to Merced and I could try and help with the investigation of Debbie's murder. Within a week, I was calling Unsolved Mysteries, and I think I called them for about 5 years, and then I got on.
did you tell the police, did you meet with the police after the funeral or within a few weeks to find out where the investigation stood or how things looked as far as the suspect or an arrest?
Well, basically, I was told there was nothing. That there was nothing on the street, there was no information whatsoever, and there was nothing for them to go on. In fact, when we moved back to California, it took about a year to sell our home. We moved back to California, and it was I got a visit from Ray Taylor, who is the detective in charge, who was sort of a very nurturing detective, you know, and he came and spoke to us in our home, and it was like there were no leads on the street. There was nothing. and they didn't believe he told anybody. And my, of course, my reply was, he has told one person, because when you don't do something so horrendous, it was a dreadful murder, as all murders are, though, you have to tell one person. And, of course, 9 years later, we find out that he had told one person, and he kept the secret for 9 years.
Gene Cervantes, can I ask you, how often is this common where the families are just kept out of the loop?
It's quite common, a lot of it has to do with the lead detectives were not wanting to jeopardize the integrity of their investigation. And it's understandable to some extent, but at the same time, there are certain facts and certain bits of information that can be and should be shared with the family.
Well, and, you know, I come from we have law enforcement in our family, but they were still hesitant to say anything. Actually, one of the lieutenants did come, and I think it was public information, and we had lunch together, and we were chatting. But there was, honestly, there was nothing there. There were no leads. There were no snitches on the street. There was nothing. And so that's when I decided that I had to keep her story out there, basically. I mean, the police were very kind to me. I have nothing but praise for the Modesto PD. But if you don't have any snitches, if you don't have any information, what can you tell the family?
Vito, why don't you weigh in on this?
Yeah, I was going to ask her. I'm waiting to hear, like, how did this... I always say in cases, even back when I was a detective on the police department, you always wait for that one nugget, okay? You find that one person, that one nugget that puts you over the top on a case like that. What was it, Jackie, with this case? What started to go in your direction, and who found it?
Oh, the piece of the puzzle, as they say.
Right, yeah,
well,
piece of the puzzle, yes.
I mean, it's kind of like a mini series what happened. For 9 years, I kept her story out there. I mean, she was everywhere. Because of citizens, I got my billboard. She was on shopping carts, Pizza Hut takeouts, bus systems, USA Today, any place I could stick her face. In fact, if we can jump forward, during the before the trial, the man that actually finally came forward said, her eyes followed me everywhere, and that's when I knew I had done my job. But if I could also say that I'm saying I, it's not just me. I mean, I had a second husband who brought me back, who put up with all kinds of nonsense from me. We put our lives on hold. There were so many good people trying to help me that that's why we had success.
Jackie, can you tell us a little bit about the victim's voice?
Oh, well, gosh. And one day I was watching television, and it was the local, and there were just regular people having television shows, and I thought, I must have been mad. Why can't I do that? And that's how the victim voice started. But I had, there was a young man, actually, who was running for office, Dennis Cardoza, and he was very victim-orientated before it was fashionable. And with his help, and also a young man called John Kano, we started the program, The Victim's Voice, and we actually started at the Assyrian Culture Center. And now we're seen in over 70 areas. And we're no longer at the Assyrian Culture Center, but we're on the local cable channels.
And that was while the case was still open, right? I mean, this was...
Yeah, that was in 19...
I
think it was... I want to say 94, 95, that we started the program. And it was it's a show where you have a police officer and a victim's family member. Very important. You have to have a family member because obviously people need to realize that you read about victim. They're not a victim. They're somebody who is loved and missed and has been killed. And so you have to have a personal touch. I always ask them to sort of share something funny about the person that has gone. And anyway, we started this program, and then all of a sudden it started taking off, and we were on more and more channels.
And
as I said, now we're on over 70 areas. Pardon?
You're still doing that today, so this has been a long-running
program
for you.
Yes, I am very blessed. In fact, even in Modesto alone, it's shown two or three times a week. A lot of areas, it's shown more than once a week.
And Jackie, getting back to the efforts you made with getting Debbie's photo out there, you said that when individual, this one person that the killer had confessed to, that after seeing Debbie's face everywhere in the billboard, it finally, I don't know how many years it took, but after seeing her, like he said, everywhere, and her eyes were following him everywhere, that finally got him to make that call, right? And
well, actually, what happened, it was it was a chance meeting, and I give so many kudos. He's now sergeant, but he was patrolman Ed Steele, Modesto PD, and he was on patrol, and he saw one of his snitches, and it was late at night, and he stopped Michael and spoke to him, and I guess Michael had a friend who had been murdered, and he'd seen what happened to the family. And so he said to Officer Steele, if you have a few minutes, or when you have a few minutes, I have information about a murder. And Ed said to him, get in the car. You know, it's like 2 in the morning, get in the car. And he said, as he was telling him the story, the hair on the back of my head stood up, and I knew it was the Whitlock murder. And after he gave him the information, and after some searching, and they found the killer in Flippin, Arkansas, leading a normal life. He was engaged, he was working, and was the best day of my life.
Jackie, I know that there's other parents and missing persons that are listening to you right now. What words of encouragement can you give them that not to give up, and what made you stay strong through all this?
Well, if we can go back to when I first came back here, I used to be a nurse, and the practitioner, actually Mary Marcus, that I worked for, we met in her lunchtime, and she said, Jackie, awful as it sounds, you have two choices. You can live or you can die. And I chose life, because by choosing life, you can work. And where there is life, there is hope. And I don't care what you do, make a list. Do something, if it's only once a month. I would watch all the TV programs. I would pick out a reporter, and I would phone them. I mean, I sent one of Geraldo's young reporters, I think it was Greg Hart. He liked tea, so I sent him a china cup and tea bags. I would send cards. I would try and form a relationship with these people, and actually it worked.
When families want to give up, and they're torn apart by this devastation, and that's another reason why we do this show. When they want to give up, what was, besides that, for you, besides sending all this and watching all the programs, what was it, your face? Was it, what kept you just getting up every day, getting dressed, and just going at it again when you just didn't have any strength?
Because nobody was going to kill my kid and get away with it while I had a voice.
Good for you.
And I, you know, some people say, oh, I just can't do this. Nonsense. I'm ordinary. Anybody,
you know,
can
Jackie,
do this. And and if I can just say, I would tell myself I can have a nervous breakdown when it's over, but I didn't.
Go ahead, Vito.
Jackie, somebody I did a case for of the same nature told me something one day after we solved the case finally. And he said to me, he said, you know, Vito, I made a decision a long time ago that there's only two ways I could go through this death of my child. Either I can go through it defeated, or I can go through it victorious. But guess what? I'm going to go through it anyway, so I might as well choose the victorious. And that's what he chose to do, because, you know, nobody can tell a mother or father how they should act. You know, I hear that so many times, and it really gets me aggravated. Oh, don't worry, everything's going to be okay. No, your child is gone. You don't tell somebody everything is okay. All right, you try to go through it victoriously. You try to do what you have to do, and you did it. You did it. But see, you kept pounding away at this. You did everything you could think of on a daily or weekly basis to get the word out. Now, that's great. The only problem with that is that a lot of people on these same type of cases are so defeated and so, how can I say it, just overwhelmed with what happened that they don't have the oomph to go and do it. And that's understandable, too, and I'm not knocking that at all. They're depressed. They hardly function. But I give you a great amount of credit for doing what you had to do, and it's – I see what people are saying on the blogs here, and it's a lot of amens going out there. So,
but you see, I'm so ordinary. Anyone can do it, but I do. I have a great second husband who is so supportive and was there with me every way, you know, every minute. And I had so many people, Daryl Farnsworth, the reporter, that I wrote him a letter and asked him to please be my daughter's champion. All these years later, we're still friends. He did her story every year. Carol Benson on radio, her story every year. I built relationships with these people. And besides, I was a pain. I called one of the shows for 5 years and finally got on.
That's amazing.
I think America's Most Wanted took 4 years. And I hired a psychic for that.
Okay.
This is Pat. Could I ask a quick question?
Denny, I'm sorry. Denny?
Yeah.
Go ahead. I didn't hear you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was just going to say, I don't think we're going to get to discuss the law issue tonight, Jackie. We'll have to have you back.
Oh, that's fine.
I did want to mention that a book has been written about Debbie's murder and your efforts to find the killer. And the title of the book, why don't you go ahead and tell us about the book?
Well, I asked, and Debbie had a stepdaughter who lived with them, and she's a journalist. And I did ask Angela, because I wanted someone to write the book who loved Debbie, if she would write the book. And I want people to know that I don't get money from this, but I'm passionate about this book that she wrote because it's an excellent book. And it's called No Room for Doubt. And actually, John Bueller, a police officer who's a friend of mine, he's the one that came up with the name. He said, because I was the only one that believed it would be solved. They kept telling me, no one knows, it won't be solved, and I knew it would be solved. I just, you know, I was arrogant about it. And it's a good book because it tells you where to go for information, you know, and anybody is welcome to call me on the victim's line if they want to. If I can, help anybody, I'd be glad to.
We will.
Can I give the
I've
number
your,
out?
Yeah, absolutely. Go right ahead.
It's 209-388-1413, and it's long distance. It's in California, but I'd be happy to share anything with anybody because Citizens Against Homicide, they were the people that helped me get my billboard when for about 3 years I kept getting turned down. And then from the billboard, we went to the bus system. If you're short of cash, I had flyers put on Pizza Hut takeouts. Pizza Hut was really good. I'm sorry about that. I know people thought I was nuts, and I thought I was a dedicated mother. So I didn't care.
Jackie,
don't listen to people.
Thank you so
I'm
much.
I'm sorry I could go on and on,
we'll,
couldn't I?
We'll have you back on again when you can tell us about the law you're trying to get enacted. And again, I read the book, No Room for Doubt. I read it, and I can attest to it. It's a great book, and the author is Angela Dove. No Room for Doubt by Angela Dove. Thank you very much, Jackie.
Thank you. And can I please tell people, if you need help, if you just need encouragement, call the number. I'll be happy to speak to you, really. And thank you, Denny. What can I say to you? This is so good for victims. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Hey, Chandra Susan? Turner, yes.
Oh, I was just going to say for 1 minute before we went on to Chandra, I wanted to ask Pat Caristo what she thought about, quickly, this mother's work, and does she see that a lot in her type of work, Pat?
I do see that a lot, not as much, but a lot. And, of course, I've been working all these years with Lois Duncan Arquette, the mother of Caitlin Arquette, and has that same dedication and will not let her daughter's case go. She had written the book, Who Killed My Daughter, and that was a 1989 case, and we still work on that case every day. We do something on that case.
I was going to say, Pat, what people I've seen, they kind of wake up each day or they go to bed that night with an agenda for the next day of what they're going to try to accomplish, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And it does help. Some people can't. And those people who can't do it should not be faulted. But that's where they turn to people like your show, me, other people. Let us maybe try to fight a little bit for you.
Because you know the system, and that's what's important, as we all do. We and it's very important too. Because sometimes, Vito and Denny, wouldn't you agree that when we get a case, that it's really the family that is sometimes has the information, and it takes just a different set of eyes because they've looked at it over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Right. That is so true, Susan. But that was a heartwarming story we just heard.
Can I get a word in, Susan? This is
yes, you can.
Jackie is very creative and innovative, and she developed relationships, et cetera. There are a lot of people out there, families, that don't have the skills that Jackie has, and I encourage them. They have a computer, go on the computer, go on the Internet, find an advocacy group that will support you and that help you. Citizens Against Homicide, just any organization in any state in your community. Call the victims advocates in the local district attorney's office. They will give you a direction to go.
Also, Gene, give us your website again so people have it and they can contact you.
My website is the website is citizensagainsthomicide.org.
And for everybody listening, it's very important if you could pass this around on your blogs. When you see cases that are posted, like by Janice Simulski, like by Morgan Harrington's family, it's very important. Pass this information, pass the website on, because the more we all spread the word, the more information's out there for people to have resources, and that's very important.
Network.
Chandra Turner was shot to death in her home in Paul's Valley on July 12, 2000. Her boyfriend claimed she shot herself while he slept through the sound of gunfire, then found herself outside in the back steps after she was dead. Crime scene photos depict blood through the inside of the home, including on the mattress he claimed he slept on. The mattress had been stripped of sheets. No one asked where they went. There were more signs of cleanup in the bedroom, including a bottle of cleaning solution on the floor. The boyfriend had fresh scratches on his arms, and Chandra was covered in bruises. This is beyond horrific. No pathology exhumed her body. Her death was ruled a suicide. Chandra did not commit suicide. The family has been fighting for 10 years. Joining us to discuss the case and the miscarriage of justice in the Oklahoma Medical Examiner's Office, which we're going to be covering for the next couple of weeks, is Jay Mendros, who is the lawyer on this for the family. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
This is devastating. You've got a crime scene that is clearly, cleaned up. What can you, from your perspective, and I know you've really dug deep into this case, what went wrong? What took place that they didn't do from the very beginning?
Well, from the very beginning, the investigation was compromised. It's my understanding that there's a relationship there between the boyfriend, stepfather, and law enforcement.
Wait a minute. Hold on. Vito, weigh in on that one for me.
Yeah, what is the relationship as you see it?
He's his stepfather, and he's a prominent attorney there. In fact, his name is in the crime scene log. He was allowed to.
Okay, how big of a town? How big of a town are we talking about that this occurred in?
Very small town. Very small town.
I knew you were going to say that. I mean, it happens. It definitely happens, Susan. Many times.
Yeah.
Sometimes, when I hear these kind of cases, my sentence that I say, if it wasn't so sad, it would be almost comical. Because this is like a Keystone Cops type of a thing. I mean, when certain things jump out at you like this, I tell you one thing before we go on. What I see on this, and I'm very glad that the family did this. The family said they weren't going to give up fighting to get justice for their daughter. The parents buried her in a sealed casket inside a sealed crypt to preserve her body for the day when they can finally get an autopsy. That was a smart, smart, smart thing to do. That's for sure.
That is. And I'm sorry. So you were saying about the crime scene and the relationship between the boyfriend and the father to the relationship to the whole crime.
To the whole crime. I mean, the whole investigation was compromised, and they didn't collect evidence. They took the boyfriend's statement at face value, although it made no sense when compared to the physical evidence at the scene. It made absolutely no sense what he said happened. He couldn't explain how blood got inside the house. He said he was sleeping while she shot herself, and nobody asked him how it was that he was sleeping on a bloody mattress. How did the blood get there if he hadn't come in contact with the body?
there's another case similar to this in Washington, Tacoma. it's Rhonda Reynolds, same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we're seeing these Peter Hyatt at record rates, aren't we? These kind of botching investigations from years before, that technology is really bringing them forward, aren't we?
Hey, I've got a question for Jane. Did you see the boyfriend statement for yourself?
I sure did. Yeah, I sure
okay,
did. In fact, I gave two statements.
Can I ask you a question about it? A couple questions.
Bet.
But most importantly, in the statement itself, did he mention saying goodnight or goodbye to her?
No, he did not mention saying goodnight or goodbye to her. But what he did mention was that she hid the guns from him. That's in his statement, that she had done.
When he went to sleep, he said that he slept there.
He said he fell asleep. He was drunk, and that she hid the guns from him. So he's trying to help himself by saying, I couldn't have shot her because she hid the guns from me. But he's really telling on himself, because why would she hide the guns from him if she wasn't afraid of him?
And why would she know, or he know?
That's right. And how would he know if he was too drunk to remember anything? But, yeah, that's his statement. And then he claims that he got the scratch on his arm from moving a dead body. That makes no sense.
So
there's an hour delay. There's an hour delay from when he said he found her to when they called the police. What did he do in that hour? Maybe that's how all the blood got in the house. You know? I mean, it's just such a ridiculous story.
Hey, Jane?
Yes.
Is this medical examiner John Miller still on the job?
Yes, he is.
Is he elected? Is he an elected official?
No. In fact, that's the reform that we're pushing for with the medical examiner's office. None of these people are elected. Absolutely none of them. From the board to the chief to the pathologist, none of them are elected.
How many cases are there like this out there right now in the Oklahoma medical examiner's office where it's just a miscarriage of justice on from the death certificate to the body autopsy? How many have you been able to find besides Chandra?
I've been able to find several, and we started Justice for the Dead, our website, justicefortheDead.com, and that just highlights the stories that people feel comfortable putting out there publicly. But I get a phone call a day at least from people saying, you keep going, you're doing the right thing. They screwed up my son's case or my daughter's case or my mother's case, and I can't relive it. I can't emotionally relive it right now, but here I'm signing your petition and I'm sending it in.
Is there a class action suit being prepared? Because, you know, it's 10 years, no autopsy, they've preserved the body, and, you know, you're trying to continue on with and putting other people's stories out there, but this case is basically, it was a suicide. That's not what happened, and clearly from the cases that I do each day on domestic violence and intimate partner homicide, there's so many red flags here. I mean, are there people that you're enlisting across the country to help you really get out there and get the word out? Because as before I had heard about this case, this is the first I had heard about what was going on there, and we need to get a way to get this out there more. But this case is still, it's unsolved, basically. It was misruled.
Well,
and
yeah,
in my opinion,
it is not an unsolved case. It's a solved case. We all know what happened. It's just a matter of getting the correct paperwork done through this medical examiner's office, and they can't seem to accomplish that because of the scandals that continuously plague them. I mean, now they're under a political corruption investigation. It's gone all the way up to the legislature.
Peter Hyatt, go ahead.
Could I ask you to email me the statements?
Peter, you were breaking up.
Could she email me the copies of the statements?
You bet, yeah. Let me get a pen. I'd love to email them.
No, I'll get it to you. No.
Okay, all right.
This
okay.
is a live
hey,
show.
Hey, Danny.
We're in the middle
hey,
of a storm here, so I might be cut out here.
Hey,
all right.
Danny, did you put up a link to this story? Did you just put this up on our site there? I see.
We're
going to
put it up after the next blog post.
It is up there now under the Chandra Turner name. It's up there. What's going on with is the father-in-law, the person that's related to the boyfriend? First of all, where the hell is the boyfriend right now?
He's still living, as far as I know, he was still living in the same house.
I mean, does he have another relationship? Has he started up with somebody else? Have police been called to that relationship that he's got now? Does anybody know anything about him?
nobody knows anything other than we do know about 6 weeks before Shanda was shot, he was arrested for reckless conduct with a firearm where someone else was shot in the foot by him, and that made the papers. That case went nowhere. You now can't even find it, but we have the newspaper article, and Shanda was alive at that time, so she was there when it happened. So everything this guy does gets covered up.
What about the Attorney General's office there? Have you tried to go to them and ask them for their help, the U.S. Attorney's office there?
We have, and the medical examiner's office ran interference. Tom
in
Jordan,
what way?
Tom Jordan, who was the OSBI guy who took over, even though he wasn't a physician, claimed that he was presenting the case to the grand jury. He told me they said that the crime scene had been altered too badly for anybody to be able to prosecute it. I called the investigator at the AG's office, and I said, is this true that you guys think you can't prosecute it? And he said, that's not exactly right. We told him the first step was we needed the death certificate to change. I called Tom Jordan back and told him that what you told me was not exactly right. I just got off the phone with the AG's office, and 2 hours later I got an email from him saying we're closing the case and we're not changing it.
Were there crime scene photos? Are they still preserved? Are they someplace of the crime scene?
Oh, yeah. We have distributed the crime scene photos to everybody who will look at them. You can look at these photos and tell this is a homicide. You don't have to be a blood pattern expert or a trajectory expert. You can look at these pictures and see that this was a homicide. This in no way looks like a suicide scene. There's too much blood. It's running upwards, not downwards. It's all over the place. It makes no sense that this was a suicide.
Hey, Susan, what happens in these cases, and it happens in many, many situations, when there is no accountability to people, okay, to other people, you're allowed to get by and get away with these type of things so constantly. And, you know, all my police career, I've never heard the statement that we are hearing now on all of these cases. If you obtain more information, we'll take another look at that. This is something that's so new over the last several years that it was something that you hardly ever heard years ago. I mean, this case just screams. I mean, the more we do this on a weekly basis, each case is getting more bizarre, and it's just incredible. But people have to do what Jackie talked about in the last segment. They got to continue to pound away, and I don't care how corrupt or who's sleeping with who or whose father-in-law is this, noise has to be made. And 10 years later, 15 years later, that's the only way this is going to work, you know?
And I think that it's important that these families aren't also, and Gene Cervantes addressed this, they're not quieted, that they're not hushed, that they're not, you know, when this much time has passed and law enforcement says, you know, you can't say anything, you have to be quiet, you can't talk, otherwise you're going to compromise an investigation. What investigation?
That's right.
Right, and they did that. They did that to this family for the first few years, and they ran the statute of limitations on a tort claim act. Mm-hmm. They gave them false hope, saying, we're looking at it again, don't worry, it's not closed, even though it was closed and nobody was doing anything, and they ran their time on suing them. So, yeah, they did that to the family, and don't talk to anybody, don't talk to the press, because you'll compromise our investigation, and they were doing nothing.
Isn't there something? Go ahead, Pat.
I was just going to say, many families don't realize this tort claim possibility, and
right.
I'm not sure that it's three years in New Mexico. I'm not sure that it's the same in every state, but people need to know that there is a civil remedy for them to give them some power and not to let that time pass.
That's correct. And it's our position that once the death certificate changes, we renew that statute of limitations is renewed because it's from the moment of discovery.
Yeah, exactly.
We're going to make that argument at some point because this family is out thousands and thousands of dollars. They're paying not only taxes for the law enforcement officers who get paid by our tax money to not do their job and the medical examiner's office who's not doing their job, they're paying all their salaries plus the private investigators and the lawyers and everybody and our experts. And it's wrong. It's absolutely wrong what they've had to go through.
Can I ask one more question?
You bet.
You commented that the medical investigator's office personnel are appointed. And is the Oklahoma police appointed also? And if that's so, who's doing the appointments?
Okay, that's the second problem. They are also not appointed. This is what we're trying to reform. By statute, the medical examiner's office, they have a board that's designated. The board members are designated by their titles, you know, the president of the OU Medical Center and the president of the Bar Association or their designee. And so there are the board members are not elected or appointed. They're just created by statute. So when everything falls apart the way it has, we cannot vote them out of office.
Mm-hmm.
We can't go to the legislature that appointed them. Nobody appointed them and nobody elected them. And they're completely misappropriating our tax dollars.
And there's no one that they have to account for.
Nobody that they are accountable to. Nobody. Nobody. In fact, we requested to speak to the board when we lost both chiefs, which violates their own statutes. The chief medical examiner's office operates under a chief. Well, when all the chiefs either got fired or ran away, we asked to talk to the board, and they declined.
You know, we are out of time, and our next guest is on, and I'm so sorry. We're going to continue this in a couple of weeks because this isn't just the tip of the iceberg, Vito and Denny, and everybody that's on. And we want to thank you for coming on. I'm going to get a hold of you, and I appreciate it. And we'll hook you up with Peter Hyatt as well. He's an investigator in Maine and an expert, and I appreciate you taking the time to call into CrimeWire. Thank you so much.
You bet. Thank you for your work.
Hey, Susan.
Okay. Yes.
Bye-bye.
Susan, we better tell our listeners the message we got from Joe Tacopina here.
Okay.
Joe Tacopina, who was doing our show, has said that he has gotten delayed on his trip from Montreal to New York. Now, he was supposed to land a long time ago. Now he's landing at 9:55 Eastern time, and he has said if he lands like 10 minutes earlier or something like that, he's going to call in right
away. That's okay. Otherwise, we've got somebody better and prettier. Why don't you introduce her? Because I'm very honored.
Well, the only one I could think of would be that lady Cheryl. Did you get her?
No. Yeah, I did. She's on.
Oh, wow. Okay. The heck with Joe, then. We'll do him next week.
That's right.
How are you doing?
Vito, go ahead.
Oh, how are you, Cheryl? How you doing?
I'm excellent.
Thank you for jumping in at the last minute.
Tonight, Cheryl McCollum's with us for the Cold Case Institute, Nancy Grace Show, and we are honored that she has filled in at the, like, virtually the last 2 minutes, but that is the beauty of technology. I weigh in a little bit. You know, we're talking about this Oklahoma coroner, medical coroner, who has just, it's been a tragedy of all these cases that have been, you know, not properly autopsied, not properly investigated. Have you ever seen anything like this anywhere else in the country?
No, I've never seen anywhere like it. And I tell you, this is going to have some effects far beyond even Oklahoma. You've got family members that live across the country. You've got, you know, other victims that are now going to start questioning what occurred with their loved one. Even if everything was proper, there's still going to be some questions. So you're opening up all kinds of re-injury situations here. And it's just devastating. This is not how this thing is supposed to work.
You know, it's amazing, Cheryl. I mean, being an ex-cop, you know, being a private detective now 20-something years, it's incredible. Mm-hmm. It's almost like some of these cases, I don't even recognize them anymore from my time as a cop. And my work as a private detective has covered a whole different sphere of how I would have done something as a cop many years ago. Because it's incredible. This case is so bizarre. But see, we're not going to go away on this either. Not only is the family not going to go away, I think Denny or Susan wrapped up that segment by saying we're going to have this on again. And we're going to have it on again.
Absolutely.
Again.
Yep.
And that's how you got to do these things.
But it's all the cases of the family. This is not the first one. In the next few weeks, we're going to highlight these families just like this one.
And that's what it's going to take. I mean, you know what a fan of the media I am. I think it's the greatest law enforcement tool that there is. I think it's the greatest vehicle for victim advocacy that there is. Especially like what y'all are doing with Blog Talk Radio. It's genius. And so it gives these families a verbal vehicle to tell their story and then to have it posted where other people can go back and listen to it later. You can reach everybody this way and then repost on Facebook and other things. So again, what you're doing what y'all have always done, and just give them such a voice that they would not have. I mean, this could have gone virtually undetected for many, many more years.
That's right.
You know, I find it scary, the number of these cases that we're hearing about. I mean, you wouldn't think there should be any. And we're getting them from all over the country. And I'm not talking just cases where somebody says, oh, I just have a gut feeling my child would never have taken his or her own life. With nothing.
Correct.
I'm talking about cases with what appear to have credible evidence.
Mm-hmm.
At least
right.
Get a medical examiner or a police agency to take a second look. And they're just totally shut out. I mean, the police or the coroner or the medical examiner won't return a phone call. They won't meet with them. And it's just incredible. It's scary to me.
And
it is scary.
The families get re-victimized, don't they, Cheryl?
They do. And that's what I was saying. This is going to open up a slew of re-victimization. Not just, I never believed they took their own life. But now they're going to have to come to the realization of, okay, I kind of dealt with that, but now you're telling me forget all of that healing. I've got to come back and know that they were actually murdered. And now I've got to look at again, who were they murdered by? And this is going to cause, I'm telling you, communities are going to start to hurt far beyond, you know, maybe what it would have even been in the first place, because they would have had that shock. They would have had the outpouring. Now it's just going to be like, oh, Lord, that was 5 years ago. Come on. He's dead and buried. Let's move on. They can't move on.
And I think that we see Vito on the eve of the Drew Peterson trial, which is July 8th. That's just around the corner. It's next week. You bring up a really good point, Cheryl. The families are being re-victimized. They had to exhume the body, you know, even
mm-hmm.
just from that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the sorry part, Cheryl and Susan, is that a lot of the families I've dealt with on these cases are very kind, nice people in the sense that
sure.
they don't bother the police. What they do is that some people even say to me, every other Monday or every third week I will call and talk to the sergeant and ask him, hi, this is Mary Smith, just checking in. And, you know, these are very nice people. These are not people calling, yelling, and screaming. I feel very bad when the police give it back to them in a wrong kind of a way. I told you I'll
right.
call you when we get something. You know, that type of an
right.
attitude. And that's how they're being victimized again and again, because all they have is their faith in the police. See, that's all they have left
right.
at this point.
But, you know, Vito, it's like when Susan and I were talking about the Drew Peterson case not long ago, that poor child has been through 3 autopsies. When is she going to be laid to rest, literally?
Well,
leave her alone.
That's right. There you're talking about a man, again, like I said before, that had no accountability. I've been
right.
in police cars. I've been in police cars where one of the rookies or something would say to a senior person, where are we going? Well, we're going over to Sergeant so-and-so's house. He once in a while he gets
mm-hmm.
in a little thing with his wife. Just be quiet
sure.
and stand there. We'll get out of there. I've seen that. It happens all
oh,
the time.
Oh, sure.
Vito, 97 times? I mean, come on.
Well, I know. It's totally wrong. It shouldn't happen one time.
But that's right.
I'm giving you the reality of how these things happen. That's Sarge's house. I've heard this stuff. That's Sarge's house. Just stand there, keep your mouth shut, and we'll get out of there real quick. Okay?
And then what does
that's
it say
it
about
goes.
The children, Vito and Cheryl? Cheryl, what does it say to the children who watch and daddy's in a uniform and the police don't do anything and then all this stuff happens? What does it say about them growing up and respecting the process and the law and justice? Does it?
Right.
One word, confusion.
Yeah.
Let me just run a comment here because we're talking about being victimized twice. I'm not at liberty to mention the agency or the individual, but a lady who's trying to find out what happened to her son, it's a cold case unsolved. The detective who was assigned to the case said, because he won't return her phone calls or anything. And he said that, and I saw this in writing, he made the comment, well, she seems to be obsessed with this thing.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to scream. She's lost her son. He was
mm-hmm.
murdered.
Mm-hmm.
She wants to know what happened to him. Yes, she's obsessed with it. What the hell kind of a parent would she be if she weren't? Look at Jackie. 9 years she went. And I just found that comment by the guy who's supposed to be seeking justice for her son to make that comment, I found it offensive. I was very, very angry. I said, no, here's the guy that she's putting her faith in that's going to get to the bottom of this, and she's a pain in the neck to him because she's obsessed with trying to find out who killed her son. I just don't get
right.
that logic whatsoever. I was absolutely furious.
And Denny, one thing we should make clear to our listeners, this is not an anti-cop show. The vast majority of the cases are handled properly. Justice is served. Okay, but you know what we're here for is sometimes when those cases are not done properly and justice is not served, because the police across this country is still the last line of defense for all of us. When that burglar's climbing through the window, you want the police to get there as soon as possible. When something's going on your street, when you call, you want those vehicles to come screeching up there. So, I mean, this is not an anti-cop dialogue. It just happens to be some of these cases that we know, all of us, Cheryl and all of us, with our expertise, that this is not right. It does not sit right with our gut. We know that we know that we know that something's wrong here.
Right.
That's right.
And because you're the last line of defense, and because you have that badge and uniform, we're not anti-cop at all, but we're anti-don't beat the hell out of your wife.
That's right.
And don't let her find in a dry bathtub, Cheryl, without water.
The vast majority of the police officers are not the Drew Petersons across this country. This is a cocky guy that thought he could do and say and act any way he wanted to do.
Absolutely.
And sometimes people think that I am just because of what I do and the nature of it, and I don't. And I wouldn't, and we wouldn't at Kremler be able to solve some of these cases or be as effective as we are if we weren't a team and if we didn't get to them and show respect and courtesy when we're trying to call and get information on cases as well.
Right.
So, Cheryl, the Cold Case Institute, why don't you just give a brief overview of what that is?
Well, we take on actual unsolved cases. The majority of the ones that y'all have heard about have been the high-profile cases, but we do take on other unknown, you know, smaller type cases. And everybody volunteers, the students. It's not a class, so they don't get a grade. They don't get any college credit whatsoever. It's not an internship, nothing. It is strictly volunteer. And we have experts across the country that are the tops of their field. So if the students have a question about ballistics or toxicology or whatever it might be, we go to that person. That's what they do for a living. The experts are also strictly volunteer. Nobody has ever been paid, including me. I get paid just to teach. I don't get paid to run the institute. And, you know, so far we've had, you know, a little bit of a, you know, success that we're happy about and we're proud of, even out of Oklahoma, as a matter of fact. We were instrumental in getting a law change there. We have 8 universities that are involved, Syracuse, Barter, Griffin Tech, Metro State College of Denver, CHI of Pennsylvania, several. And everybody has a different expertise. So Metro State College of Denver, for example, does the crime mapping. They have a crime mapping lab that's certified by their state and the federal government. Faulkner University, which is run by Lou Harris, former FBI profiler, they do the victimology for us. CHI out of Pennsylvania does the crime scene reenactment. Griffin Tech does forensics. Is there anything new? Is there any kind of technology we can, you know, use now that maybe wasn't available then? And what we do is at the end of the year, and it takes about a year to do each cases or, you know, each case load. Hopefully, when everybody turns in their final report, it all adds up to be the same guy or same perpetrator. And we've worked on Natalie Holloway. We consider that one solved. We worked on Chandra Levy. We worked on Amber Hagerman, Tupac Shakur, Wayne Williams. And then, you know, some lesser cases, the Morris Ford Bridge, which is the last mass lynching in the United States. We worked on Mary Shotwell Little, which was the largest manhunt in the city of Atlanta. So, you know, we've worked on some pretty significant cases, but it's been the experts that literally come in and work one-on-one with these students that I think is probably the most remarkable element to the whole thing.
Wow, that is real incredible. That is incredible. What is your criteria, Cheryl, for picking cases? How do you determine what case you're going to take or get involved in?
Okay, that's an excellent question. The first thing I've got to do is I've got to find an area of study that is new for them. So like with Morris Ford Bridge, that was going to be a hate crime. Tupac Shakur, is it gang-related? Natalie Holloway, it was underwater crime scene, thing like that. So they will have an area of study that they can really gain some expertise in. And then I bring in whatever leading expert is right now in that field. And incidentally, I want to be real clear about something if I can. I have never once had an expert tell me no, that they weren't interested or they didn't have time or that they wanted money. So I think that speaks to the kind of folks that are in criminal justice as well. And I just want to say that. So not just the students, but you've got people like Dr. Fascitelli that, you know, they make a really good living. She's never asked for a dime. She hasn't even been given a college sweatshirt. So I think it's incredible when they can sit down with a psychopathologist and kind of work this theory about what happened to Amber Hagerman and who took her, and then bring in a profiler to kind of refine it. And then, just like the real world, I also bring in, you know, psychics. And they sometimes, you know, add or, you know, make things clear. We also, Vito, we don't take on a case that the family doesn't say, yes, please help us.
Right.
The family has to sign off on it. And we do that for a lot of reasons. One, I've got to have the victimology. And two, I want that family to know that even though your case might be 40 years old or 60 years old, somebody still remembers and somebody still cares. And we put the victim's photo up in the institute, and we look at them every day. We know who we're working for. Mm. The students know exactly what they're doing, and they've met the mama or the daddy or the husband or the children. And it's very real to them. This is not, hey, let's go, you know, play police for a minute. It's not that at all. They know Beth Holloway. They've sat with her many times. They've sat with the mothers from the missing and murdered children. They know. They know exactly what their job is and how important it is. So when they turn their findings, and it's the third thing, we never publish our results. We don't talk to the media and say, hey, we solved this. All of our reports, the final one, we do what we call an action plan. And if we think there's somebody that needs to be re-interviewed, or we think there's an element of forensic science that could be utilized that, again, may not have been, you know, available at the time, that goes in the report to try to help law enforcement say, hey, we're not Monday morning quarterbacking. We're just saying, from what we were able to ascertain, we think this is a good plan of action that maybe deems this thing a little more solvable than it was a week ago. And then all of our experts put their two cents in so that when all is said and done, you've got a professional crime map, a professional profile. All of these things go in. Here's the best that the people across the country have to give you. You know, Godspeed, whatever you can do with it. And again, for my students, when they get a call back from somebody of the caliber of a Sheila Ross and says, hey, I got your theory. It's got some legs. I appreciate it. I think it's viable. Well, honey, they're just on cloud nine. When they turn in a report to Metro in D.C., and 8 weeks later they arrest Igmar Gwadiki, you can't begin to contain, you know, the life-changing momentum that's happened to these students that are getting an undergraduate degree. These are not master's level, doctorate level folks, but they've got real world experience and they've got the heart and they've got, you know, the time a little bit, some of them, you know, but you know, most of our students, you know, they work and they've got children and they've got husbands and they've got homes and, you know, they come and give time anyway.
I mean, you're dedicated. I mean, that's, yes, go ahead, Denny.
Yeah, Cheryl, you mentioned psychics. What kind of response do you get if you contact a police agency and indicate that there's a psychic involved? Is it mixed or is it pretty negative? Or what's your experience?
No, it's actually been very positive. For the most part, everybody just says, thank you. You know, we appreciate it. Now, again, this report has several elements to it. The psychic is one, and we are very clear that we understand this is nothing you can go get a warrant for. This is maybe accurate, maybe not accurate, but I'll tell you something interesting. We have a psychic that works with our profiler, and we will put them in separate rooms, and a lot of times they are straight down the line the same.
Mm-hmm.
The students get a kick out of it. It's one of the most fascinating events that we have. But the other thing that happens is, again, I go to the family, and I say, is this something you want me to try, yes or no? I've never once had a family say no. They usually say, good Lord, try anything. Please, if she's got a gift, God love her. What's it going to hurt? And like I normally tell the students, look, I don't have a crystal ball. I can only do so much. If there's somebody that could come in that has a gift, I welcome it. If it turns out that they can flip something, great. If not, we haven't lost anything. We're working a case right now. Hell, it's 40 years old. What possible harm could there be when we approach it knowing this is what it is? She's only here to help. Again, she's not getting paid. She doesn't want anything. She doesn't publish anything. She doesn't write a blog. She's not, you know, pimping us out saying, hey, I'm an expert at the Cold Case Institute, so now I'm going to charge more money. She's not getting anything out of it. She just wants to help. And incidentally, she was dead on the money with Shonda Levy. She was dead on the money with Natalie Holloway, even in her prediction of a second event that would be more violent to our knowledge. So again, I mean, I'm not here to tell you, hey, contact a psychic of whether or not you should be married. Not at all. But I'm saying in a case where there is nothing else that you know to do, you've exhausted all leads, I don't see any harm if the family says, please try.
We are out of time, guys. Cheryl, come back to us, please. This was an honor, and I thank you for coming in and really making this show a wonderful ending. I hope you'll come back when we cover the Drew Peterson case that we'll be covering
anytime
through the trial.
Anytime.
Thank you to the CrimeWire team, to producer Kim Colton, public relations team manager at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will be on Tuesday, July 6, 2010. Tune in when we continue to analyze cases, crimes that interrupt and wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice. Denny?
Thank you. Thank you for joining us tonight on CrimeWire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guest. If you would like your case to be featured on CrimeWire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Or hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com, turn on the volume at your computer, and the show will automatically play. And remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. Visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com.
Good night, everybody, and God bless. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Bye-bye.